And a very warm welcome back to Solidarity Breakfast.
A left response to the major developments in capitalism.
What they trade in is not wheat. They trade in famine.
A little dose of revolutionary optimism.
I think it's really important to sort of express solidarity globally.
It really is a deal by corporations for corporations.
The union forever defending our rights. Down with the black leg.
If you think the ABC's left wing, don't listen to this program.
Solidarity Breakfast, 7:30 to 9 a.m. Saturdays, 3CR, 8:55 a.m. Streaming and 3CR digital, podcast or audio on demand. And of course, the website, solidaritybreakfast.org.au.
Solidarity forever!
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you, Tobias?
Yeah, good. Good.
Solidarity Breakfast, as we've been telling you, yes. Best thing on since sliced bread, yeah. On a Saturday morning, very cold. I have met a couple of people who say the 3CR just outshines itself on a Saturday morning over the last week.
Humbly, you know, we do our business.
We do our best.
Yeah.
That's the saying.
Yeah.
And today we've got a few short headlines because we've got an action-packed
Jammed, packed program.
Yeah, so we've got to get a wriggle on.
Yeah. So just a few things that I wanted to bring up. Pilar forwarded us a message from the court case from Adriana Rivas, who is the escaped... If you catch up, listeners, she's the escaped human rights abuser from the Pinochet government. So former Pinochet regime agent Adriana Rivas has suffered a major setback in her fight against extradition to Chile. The federal court in New South Wales today, Friday, July 18th of July, when we received this, denied her request for permission to appeal a previous ruling which had blocked her access to key government documents. Her lawyers argued that these reports could have helped stop her return to Chile, where she faces charges of crimes against humanity, charges she denies. Judge Aaron Longbottom also ordered Rivas to pay the legal costs of this latest attempts. Families of the victims in the case welcomed a swift verdict, delivered in under 2 weeks, but expressed concern over what they describe as secrecy around the funding of legal moves that have delayed Rivas' extradition. Their Australian representative, lawyer Adriana Navarro, called for transparency. Rivas has been in custody in New South Wales since February 2019, following Chile's extradition request. Her arrest came after she spoke out in an SBS exclusive interview describing her illegal escape across the Andes and flight to Australia. In 2020, a Sydney magistrate ruled she met the conditions for extradition, but her appeals to higher courts have so far been unsuccessful.
Doom, boom. Good show. A bit of bad news. Developers of a proposed $10 billion Victorian offshore wind farm has abandoned the project, prompting fears Australia may not reach its renewable energy target. You will remember the Spirit of the South wind farm off East Gippsland Coast championed by the MUA. It appears to be dead in the water because of there being no investment. I'll give you a little bit more information about this particular thing. Gippsland Dawn was to be a 2 gigawatt offshore wind farm built between Paradise Beach and Ocean Grange on the Gippsland coast. The proposal received major project status from the federal government in November and promised to deliver power to more than 1 million homes, but the company behind the project, Blue Float Energy, withdrew from offshore wind internationally after major shareholder Quantum Capital said it was no longer commercially viable to invest in the sector, which is kind of interesting because if you follow through the stuff about the wind offshore wind farms, there seems to be a pattern. In January, a South Australian offshore wind farm industry appears dead in the water after the cancellation last week of a proposed $2 billion project slated to be built at Kingston in the southeast. The Kingston decision follows a similar move earlier in the year when the proposed Port MacDonald offshore wind project was shelved. Then in March, and some people might think this was particularly a good outcome, but there was a... They withdrew where is it? Here it is. they withdrew flotation energy $6 billion offshore wind farm off 90 Mile Beach in Victoria in March. And the federal government has denied the company a feasibility license in the wake of a court battle and changes to offshore wind legislation. There's lots of people who would be thinking that having these blades off 90 Mile Beach would be a real eyesore. But as the person from the company said, they do not understand why the government has gone to such lengths to avoid approving the project. That's what's so hard to understand about this decision. It seems to go against the government's own policy of renewable energy and cheaper power into the grid and more jobs in regional areas. We are struggling to understand why they have chosen to go down this path. It just doesn't make sense. The company is now disbanding the project, resulting in the loss of 20 project jobs as well as 1,000 anticipated jobs once the project was operational. The point I'm making, I guess, is that there appears to be a pattern developing where a series of offshore wind farm failures despite rampant go-aheads for fossil fuel projects, leading to evidence that Australia may be dead in the water because of the failure to reach climate targets, which is pretty disturbing, especially when the federal court says climate change poses an existential threat to all of humanity, despite finding law does not currently support claims. Impacts of human-induced climate change laid bare in federal court judgment in Uncle Paul and Uncle Papaya's landmark Australian climate case earlier in the week. In Cairns, the federal court accepted the factual case presented in Uncle Papaya and Uncle Paul's landmark Australian climate case, but found that the law, this is in inverted commas, the law does not currently support their claim that the government has a legal duty of care to protect the Torres Straits, its people and their culture from climate harm. The federal court found that while the Torres Strait Islands people and culture are being ravaged by, and this is in inverted commas, ravaged by human-induced climate change, and that climate change poses an existential threat to the whole of humanity, that's also in inverted commas, the Australian government does not currently have a legal duty of care to protect Torres Strait people from climate harm. His Honour said that when the Commonwealth identified and set Australia's greenhouse gas emissions reduction targets in 2015, 2020 and 2021, it failed to engage with or give any real or genuine consideration to what the best available science indicated was required for Australia to play its part in the critically important global objective enshrined in the Paris Agreement of significantly reducing greenhouse gas emissions and thereby moderating global warming and reducing the prospect of the worst and most dangerous impacts of climate change. This is just outrageous.
Yeah, and in terms of outrage, I'm thinking of a particular apartheid state that just dropped bombs in Syria right near the presidential palace in an attempt to cow the already destabilizing force that is the newly installed government there. But not only that, in other apartheid news, in the Northern Territory, Chief Minister Leah Finocchiaro has announced, well, actually she quite coyly was saying, caught saying that, you know, lots of her constituents would support the move to install the castle law in the local governance. Castle law being if the right to shoot someone and with impunity if they enter your house. This is off the back of Leah Finocchiaro saying that she'll give bus drivers and mall cops guns. Local advocacy groups, Justice Not Jails, have said that the Chief Minister's comments that she does not fear police demonstrates her profound privilege and disconnection with Indigenous communities across the territory who bear the brunt of racist policing, and that the police have a history of using dangerous and unnecessary force, particularly against First Nations people and people of colour. The Chief Minister's dismissive attitudes towards those who are raising concerns about guns being allowed on buses is consistent with her government's refusal to consult with the community about what would genuinely make us feel safer.
How did she get voted in?
Yeah, look, she's presiding over a government that, you know, dropped the criminal age of responsibility to 10. So, and the UN is 16, the recommendation for criminal age of responsibility, which we don't even have here. I think it's 14 in Victoria, but it's 10 in Northern Territory. People need to be reaching out in solidarity and really all eyes on the Northern Territory for what's going on. We'll go now to Comrade Vivian Langford, who's recorded a piece for us for the Voices for Palestine. This is a Palestine rally held in Sydney on July the 13th. The first speaker being from the Australian Jewish Council. And we'll also hear from David Rovick's new song.
The report of Gillian Siegel, the so-called anti-Semitism envoy. But I have to express some discomfort. This week, the UN has declared that Israel's starvation of Gaza is now worse than ever. But instead of discussing a plan to halt a genocide, our leaders are discussing a plan to halt criticism of a genocide. That is what the Special Envoy's plan to combat anti-Semitism is. It is an authoritarian document, straight out of Donald Trump's playbook. It calls for state power to be wielded against any university, charity, media outlet, or indeed any individual that runs afoul of the discredited IHRA definition of anti-Semitism. A definition disowned even by its own lead author for how it has been weaponized against any and all criticism of Israel and Zionism. We, the Jewish Council, reject the Special Envoy's plan. The Jewish Council rejects the concept of a special envoy itself. Anti-Semitism is real, just as many forms of racism and bigotry are real. And it does no movement any benefit to pretend otherwise. But we reject the exceptionalization of anti-Semitism as a bigotry separate from all others. We reject it because only by challenging all forms of bigotry in solidarity with each other, will we ever address the form that targets Jews. We reject it because we know, far from mitigating anti-Semitism, Orwellian proposals like the envoy's plan will likely inflame anti-Semitism and encourage the false idea that Jews have some special, sinister privileges and protections. We reject it because if any people can be exceptionalized for protection, they can be exceptionalized for oppression. Equality, dignity, and safety for all is the only thing that will protect us or any minority, because it is the only thing in the long run that ever has. But I want to cease humouring this plan, because it was never about fighting anti-Semitism. The envoy is not an expert in fighting extremism. She is an expert in fighting for extremism. She is unapologetically a career lobbyist for Israel. We are expected to be lectured on hatred by someone who called Gazans barbarians, who called for protests like this one to be banned, who opposed even temporary ceasefires in Gaza, and who backs Trump's plan to expel all of its population. She even has nice things to say about Elon Musk. Are we really supposed to take seriously a plan to make our universities safe from hate from someone who is comfortable with the destruction of every single university in Gaza? A plan to protect our places of worship from someone comfortable with the bombing of Gaza's churches and mosques? A plan to promote Holocaust education from someone who supports a government that is, as we speak, planning a concentration camp in Rafah? This was never about fighting anti-Semitism. It was never about protecting my community. It was about using my community as a human shield for Israel, of conscripting our identity, our fear, our trauma, our fear as a weapon to be wielded on anyone who resists, including Jews. Zionism has built a hell in Palestine, a hell that is swallowing up Israel and wants to drag every Jew around the world down with it. This Jew joins thousands of other Jews who says no more, who stand on a religious tradition that values the sanctity of human life above almost everything else, that calls for the liberation for all of God's children, who lives by the words of Marek Elderman, the anti-Zionist leader of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, who said to be a Jew means to be always with the oppressed and never with the oppressor. But why this plan now? It is because the Zionist lobby is losing and they know it. Be it at the ballot box or in the courtroom or in the newsroom, it is failing, it is panicking, it is desperate. Once upon a time, the lobby thought it could make the world love a settler colonial state. No longer. And if they can't protect Israel's reputation, they have to try and destroy all of ours. So I want to say this to Gillian Siegel and all the other pro-Israel lobbyists. We are not afraid of you. The Jewish Council of Australia is not afraid of you. The Palestine Solidarity Movement is not afraid of you. Nor are the Council for Civil Liberties, MIA, Amnesty International, Labour Friends of Palestine, the Greens, and many others who have rejected the extremism in this plan. This was never about fighting anti-Semitism, because Zionism cannot live without anti-Semitism. It is an ideology that lives through fear, the fear of those it oppresses in Palestine and those it vilifies here, but also the fear it demands and fans in we, the diaspora Jews, who are told that this isn't really our home, that our real home is in some walled settlement in the West Bank. They want us to feel afraid of our Muslim and Arab brothers and cousins and sisters, and they are afraid of us, because the thing they fear most is what I see before me. Jews, Palestinians, and people of conscience marching together in the name of equality and liberation for all, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free!
Palestine will be free! From the river to the sea! Palestine will be free! From the sea to the river! Palestine will live forever! I'd like to introduce our second speaker, who is David Rovick and Kamala Emanuel, who are anti-war musicians who have stood alongside Palestine for many, many years. Make them feel welcome.
If you sing the little refrain of this next song with us, and if you were in the UK, you could go to prison for 14 years, because this song violates the UK Terrorism Act of 2000, Section 12, now that the new law against Palestine action has been passed by the Parliament, 350 votes to 26. So the chorus at the end, the refrain, let's practice breaking UK law together here, okay? It goes, I support Palestine action, I oppose genocide. I support Palestine action, I oppose genocide. I support Palestine action, I oppose genocide. So if you don't want to break UK law, just stay quiet. And if you do, then sing with us. Since long before this moment, but especially since then, the Western world's governments have supported the killing of children by Israeli soldiers without fail every day, gunning them down with weapons made in the UK. Palestine action formed to try to end these arms sales that The courts could not defend. The courts could not defend them. So the parliament became the vehicle to support the bombing of the tents, which needs to be supported. So says the British state, tied from 26 MPs who failed to conflate supporting terrorism with opposing Israeli crimes by those who think we're living in some very scary times, where it is now against the law to express sympathy with those who would destroy corporate property. Illegal to say with eyes open wide, I support Palestine action, I oppose genocide. International law, along with UK law as well, forbids such weapon sales to countries like Israel. That is, countries that are committing crimes of war are not allowed to import, no access to the store. But in London and Berlin, they just look the other way at these inconvenient laws. There's a new one today, solidarity imprisoned and vilified if you support Palestine action and oppose genocide. As we bear witness to this constant slaughter, depriving Gaza of food and water, bombing children day and night, where body parts strewn are in hourly sight, the authorities take aim and then crack down on those who dare dissent in London town, who must stand up, not stand aside, who support Palestine action and oppose genocide. Or will we disappear, have a Spartacus moment or a time of fear, back down and go home, or stand with humanity, support the war machine or support sanity? We'll see what comes next in the story of the descent of Keir Starmer and his kindercidal government. We'll see who's willing to shout with pride, I support Palestine action, I oppose genocide. I support Palestine action, I oppose genocide. I support Palestine action. I oppose genocide.
The convergence on Canberra. So nationally, activists will be meeting at Canberra to protest the genocide in line with the very first sitting week of the new Labor government. Still survived the ongoing genocide in Gaza. And he's still living there. He shared this message with us yesterday. These are the most difficult days of the starvation in the Gaza Strip and the most devastating for the citizens. Indeed, without any exaggeration or distortion, citizens are living in a real famine. There is no aid, goods are scarce, and prices are astronomical, even for those with money who cannot afford them. Citizens are exhausted by war and displacement and have no money. Commission rates for withdrawing money are 45%. Many people told me that they and their children have not eaten bread or any other food for several days. Bread is the main and only meal on the table here. Despite claims that various types of aid have entered since Netanyahu announced its entry about a month ago, American and Israeli companies distributing food in dangerous locations, and this has led to the death of 798 civilians, according to a recent UN report. However, we have warned that all of this aid is merely misleading media propaganda aimed at silencing international criticism and covering up the military genocide being perpetuated by the occupation. However, in reality, this aid does not reach more than 80% of citizens, for several reasons related to the scarcity of aid itself, theft and looting on the road or from warehouses, and poor organisation and distribution. In practice, citizens have been besieged and starving since the 2nd of March, the first day the occupation closed the crossings up until now. That is for 131 consecutive days. Nothing new has entered their homes. This is in addition to their complete deprivation of all type of meat products, dairy, vegetables and fruits. Aid is limited to canned goods, dried legumes and starchy foods such as rice and pasta. This is in addition to the deprivation of medical treatment, which has caused the deaths of thousands. This is a message to those concerned. Citizens in the Gaza Strip are suffering from the most severe forms of starvation, torture and the deprivation of their basic rights, especially in recent days. All the talk about allowing aid into the Strip is not reaching those who deserve it, who are paying their lives and health as a high price for a false propaganda promoted by those who profit from preventing food from reaching the needy and hungry in Gaza. This is obviously the lives that a lot of people in Gaza are currently living, and as we come here in March every week, I also ask that everyone pray for everyone in Gaza and hope that they reach safety and security soon.
Comrades, friends, siblings all over this continent, I urge every one of you to join us in Canberra. I refuse to be silent while Gaza is being annihilated. History will judge us all. No one will be able to say they didn't know, that they didn't see, that they didn't hear. The screams and pain are reaching every one of us from the screens we hold in our hands. Now is the time to act. July 20. I urge, I beg each and every one of you, each person of good conscience, to stand with us in Canberra. Together we can send this simple, clear message. The Albanese government must sanction Israel now. When governments fail, responsibility falls upon the citizenry to act. If we don't stand up now, then when? Join us in Canberra, July 20. It's time for the Albanese government to sanction Israel.
People tasted freedom, soon those hellish skies turn to blue and starry nights as our voices start to rise. We're ending an apartheid.
3CR Community Radio, giving voice to the community since 1976.
And you're back with Annie and Tabea on Solidarity Breakfast. Have to say thank you very much to all those people who came to our event on Saturday, last Saturday. It was a great and exciting little affair, wasn't it, Tabea?
Yeah, lots of all the musicians were incredible. Oh,
they were great.
Great to see lots of smiling faces that were happy with... even though the raffle debacle, all those sticky raffle tickets,
yeah, never mind. But it all ended in happiness, and everybody had a good old time.
Yeah,
it was
someone
great.
Took home the coveted crumpler bag.
That's right, and the tattoos and the hairdo.
Yeah,
Let's hope the hairdressing went to a person who had a fine set of hair, who probably doesn't even want a haircut, but I'm sure he'll make friends.
Maybe he'll get some colour in it or something.
Yeah, exactly.
But if you want a piece, you can also go to the 3CR website and pick up a Solidarity Breakfast t-shirt. We've got pre-orders until the end of August, and then we'll ship them out.
Okay.
So... go on there, $50. You can pick them up at the front desk, order and support your favourite breakfast show.
Yeah. We're going, Nilla's a bit under the weather this morning, but she's contributed an interview today. It's Hunter and Anushka. They're from Stop Woodside Monash. It's they've got an event on the 20th, but it tells you all about it at the end of the interview.
My name is Hunter. I'm a student at Monash University, studying environmental science and environmental engineering.
My name is Anushka, and I'm a first year at Monash University, and I study global studies.
And yeah, we're a part of Stop Woodside Monash.
Can you tell us a little bit more about Stop Woodside?
Woodside Monash, we're a grassroots group of students and staff. We're trying to build a network of people who want to see the end of the partnership between Monash University and Woodside Energy, and this is worth a lot of money. We don't know how much it's worth because Monash have been very secretive. And our mission is to have this partnership ended and Woodside's name taken off the technology and engineering building.
So can you tell us a little bit more about Woodside and why you view the Woodside-Monash partnership as being so nefarious?
Woodside is a massive energy company here in Australia. They are responsible for the largest amount of pollution in the country. So they've been in a partnership with Monash University since 2019. Also have partnerships internationally as well. Like they have a partnership in the US, I believe, Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
They've approved a $17.5 billion deal where they actually can make a station over there, which is, again, very concerning. So it's not just a domestic issue, it's an international issue. And for Woodside to be having this partnership with this Monash University is very scary. We know that there's about $100 million partnership with Monash that we know of, just the lack of transparency. We are really trying to get that partnership removed because there is a lot of shady business going on. We want transparency and honesty.
And the other reason Woodside's been in the news recently is the recent extension of the Northwest Shelf. Can you talk a little bit more about why that specific program is so concerning?
It's part of the Burrup Hub. if you look at a map, it scales the whole Western Australian coast. So it includes the Scarborough gas plant, the Browse Basin. It's tens of gas locations across the whole WA coast. And the Northwest Shelf, being approved by Murray Watt, is Woodside's first step into the Burrup Hub, which is 6.1 billion tonnes of carbon, equivalent to 12 times Australia's annual emissions. Across this coast, we have fragile marine ecosystems. I was talking to Simon, one of our academics, yesterday about the sound that the drilling produces, and it's equivalent to a jet engine pretty much running 24 hours every day. And you have blue pygmy whales migrating up this coast who use sound to migrate and communicate with each other, and they're literally drilling into the Scott Reef to extract this gas. And there's this whole dialogue about carbon capture, blah, blah, blah. Woodside is literally Mr. Burns. Like, the more I learn about them, the more I just see them going, yeah, yeah.
It is incredibly worrying for the emissions that's going to be emitted, because it's going to be the largest fossil fuel project to ever been approved in Australian history. And the plan for the extension is to go till 2070.
Yeah.
And Monash University is saying that, oh, we support Woodside's plan to go net zero by 2050. But our question is, how mm-hmm. can you plan to go net zero by 2050 when Woodside is pumping oil and gas till 2070? Yeah. So we just want a bit of understanding there, because it just sounds that Monash University is contradicting themselves. Exactly. So,
well, on that note, talking about Monash's purported commitment to climate action, Monash University maintains that they don't hold any direct investments in fossil fuels, and that their most recent environmental, social and governance statement positioned the university as a leader on climate action. How do you feel about those claims? Do you think that's an accurate representation of Monash's relationship to the fossil fuel industry?
Just a bit of history on the ESG statement. 2016, Monash said that it had no direct investments in fossil fuels. So this is where the lies kind of start. And then we look into the ESG report, and it says it makes no direct investments in coal, tobacco, and it's not all weapons. It's like clustered ammunitions or something. But it shows us that Monash is capable of divesting, because it has got out of these things before. You know, this year we have this partnership up for renewal, and the ESG can be changed to include fossil fuels, which it currently does not. So I should mention it's out of coal, but not oil and gas. And we are pushing for the removal of all fossil fuels to lead this change from the tertiary level, and hopefully that will lead other universities like the Uni of South Australia, who's in a partnership with Santos, and hopefully provide a precedent for that. In recent years, it's really felt like communities have been disregarded, and it's just lobbyists who are listened to. I think by having a strong environmental and social governance policy at Monash, we can really set a precedent for other universities and lead to long-lasting change, so we don't have these partnerships occurring again. Because we know how bad these ties are. Monash knows it. That's why they're being so secretive about it. And the more we keep pushing, the higher into bureaucracy it gets, and it seems like it's going forever.
So you just mentioned that Monash has been secretive about the details of this partnership. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so we launched an FOI, which is Freedom of Information, and we are able to do that as Monash is a public institution, and it's been delayed, essentially. So they got back to us, and they actually have 22 documents surrounding the partnership with Monash University and Woodside. But unfortunately, we are not being given those 22 documents, essentially, as it's due to being commercially sensitive towards mm-hmm. Woodside Energy. And we are just like, hey, like, what's going on? Like, we're asking for transparency, and here you are saying that it's commercially sensitive. So now we're appealing through OVIC, which is the Victorian Office for Information.
Yeah.
So we're just waiting for a response from there to see if it's actually within FOI law that Monash is withholding those 22 documents, because, as we've said before, there is such a lack of transparency around the partnership,
mm-hmm.
and we want to know why they are actually not giving us any single document, not even like a redacted document. Yeah. Like, this is just unheard of.
We didn't get a word.
This is just unheard of. So we are really asking, why aren't we being given any sort of information here?
And there have been some other issues with Monash's transparency around their relationship to Woodside. Recently, they had a conference on their Prado campus, Monash's Prado campus in Italy. Can you tell us a bit more about what that conference was about and how Monash kind of maybe blurred the edges around what was going on at that conference?
Absolutely. So this conference was held in Prato, which we actually have a campus over there. And this was held in June 2024. And essentially it was to kind of, you know, do a little meeting or a conference, I would say, on how we can kind of be more sustainable and be more renewable with our partnership.
Is that the partnership with Woodside?
Yes, that is the partnership with Woodside. That is correct. This is that people at this conference were asked to submit papers on how activism and how kind of cancel culture was actually harmful to this transition. And we were deeply, we were worried about that. We were like, well, why are you saying these? Like, why is activism kind of harmful towards this transition? So we were kind of wondering, like, okay, that's kind of strange. And then after the conference actually concluded, about a few weeks later, the actual like website linking to the conference and kind of what the conference was about mysteriously was deleted. There was a liberal person there who was, I think it was
Tim Wilson.
Tim Wilson, yeah.
I mean, he was a keynote speaker, I think.
Yeah.
Then there you go. Like,
yeah, and if anyone's keen to read more about this, an investigative journalist, Royce Kamelovs, he published this awesome article in The Guardian. So if you just look up Stop Woodside Monash Prado Conference or something, I'm sure you can get the full details of it all. It's really interesting, very sketchy business.
And I think through that article, you can also go and have a look at the conference website that's now been taken down through the Wayback Machine. So probably good to go and have a look at that to hold them accountable, I would say.
Yeah, exactly.
Can you tell us a little bit more about what type of actions you've been taking to try and push back against Woodside's relationship with Monash?
We've been writing an article for Monash's student paper, and that was kind of just an explainer to all students and staff of what was happening with FOI and our actions and why we believe Woodside is a horrible, disgusting partner to have at our university. Working with Royce as well, he published a deep dive into the partnership, and that was published in Crikey in Australia and Drilled in America.
Definitely check out the stuff we have in The Guardian and in Crikey, because there's a lot of information there, and it really has kind of mobilised our movement. Like, a lot of people have now become aware of what we're doing.
Recently, you were involved in organising a funeral for Australia's climate future. Maybe you could tell us a bit more about that.
Absolutely. So when Murray Ward signed the approval for the extension, we were like, that there goes the hopes for climate action, because as we've said before, this is the largest fossil fuel project to ever be approved in Australian history. Basically, our team, we did a mini little protest in front of the Woodside building. We had about 25 people there, and we were just there for about an hour and a half, and we just spoke about what the extension looks like for climate action and how we're all feeling. I actually spoke there, and it was the first time kind of meeting everyone and the collective and just other students that were just feeling a lot of grief and sadness. I was just so heartbroken with the decision, and it felt really comforting to just be around other students and staff who like felt the same way that I did.
On that note, can you tell us a little bit more about what it's like being a young person in Australia watching the government continue to approve these projects? And maybe what prompted you to do something about it?
Yeah, it's a really good question. In terms of being a young person, I think Australia is just such an incredible country for its nature. And, like, I grew up in the country and have always really been moved by the Australian bush and our ecosystems and this unique place that we live on and the incredible history and culture of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders here. And just the fact that the government just seems to be controlled by money, and it seems to be a real pattern that I've been seeing and learning about as I've been at university. And as a climate science student, like, I'm constantly learning about how carbon emissions are completely destroying ocean currents, and you name it. Like, every day.
It's bleak.
And the fact that I'm learning this stuff at university and my incredible lecturers are putting their hard, you know, work into teaching us this stuff, and on the way to those classes and after those classes, I'm looking up at the Woodside building, which is Australia's biggest fossil fuel emitter, and it just seems like absolute hypocrisy of Monash, and it's disrespectful to the staff who was putting their time into teaching us this stuff. It's disrespectful to us because we're getting a degree in climate science when even the university isn't looking to positive change. So as a young person, I think for both of us, like, we find it really disrespectful from Monash to be in this partnership. We find it, you know, there's not a lot of hope in climate sometimes. And if even our universities aren't really pushing for change, it's like it makes you want to give up. But I think being in this group has given me power and realizing that, you know, everyone is feeling this and we're all feeling like not listened to. And this grassroots community has been really amazing for me, like, to get my optimism back and see people want change and everyone around Australia, like, the people can unite and we have so much power in community. And even though we're all incredibly busy, we're also passionate about this stuff and we're actually getting a lot done. Like, it feels like it's snowballing a bit and people are getting around the cause. And, you know, a couple months ago it was not many of us, and now we're really, you know, Anushka's come on in the last couple months and really doing a lot of action. So yeah, like, it's an emotional roller coaster. That's all I can say.
Anushka, do you have anything to add?
Absolutely. So, as I said before, my degree is global studies, and we have covered a lot on climate action and how climate change is a threat. A lot of people see climate change as political. It's not political. It is just a straight up fact. Like, that is the science. Our temperatures are increasing. Our carbon productions, they are also increasing. Actually learning about the threats of climate change and how it affects marginalized communities as well. I mean, look at First Nations people in our communities. It will affect them first, and our shorelines as well around Australia. Like, people don't think we're being affected. We are being affected. Look at the temperatures in May. It has never gone up to 25 to 26 degrees in May. That is unheard of.
Not to mention the 2020 bushfire season as well.
Absolutely. Exactly. It's just hypocrisy that I'm in classrooms learning about the threats of climate change, and just a 5-minute walk away from me is the Woodside building, and our institution is in bed with climate criminals.
Yeah.
I just question why. You're teaching us about the threats of climate change, and you've essentially just greenwashed Woodside, essentially. Like, classmates will be like, oh, we're just going to head off to the Woodside building. Do you even know what the Woodside building is? Do you know what Woodside is? Monash and Woodside have kind of come together and essentially just greenwashed what Woodside is. It's just shocking, and it's worrying. But as Hunter was saying, I think by joining this group, it has definitely made me feel like I'm in control a little bit, because I have felt very powerless. I feel very small sometimes. I feel like I'm unable to do things. By definitely joining Stop Woodside Monash, it has given me like a sense of hope that what we're doing is actually important. The university knows what we're doing. We are hopeful that we are able to get some information out of them. There's a lot of us now, and we're just growing. One thing for me is that I've always felt kind of like alone when kind of fighting on social issues and kind of being an activist for a very long time now. I've felt isolated at times. So by actually meeting other people who are incredibly passionate about wanting to see change and will actually essentially not give up, we refuse to let the institution silence us. Mm-hmm. Like, we genuinely refuse. We are paying thousands of dollars for our degrees. God knows when we're going to be able to pay it back. It's just shocking to me how an institution like Monash can try and silence us, but we refuse to do that. So it's been incredibly empowering to be around like-minded people who are willing to put in the time, both staff and students. It's just absolutely incredible team to be around of, and I'm very proud of our team.
Yeah.
And you've also been endorsed by the Monash Teachers Union on campus, as well as the Monash Student Association.
Yep.
So you can kind of see that there's a bit of a community coming together this issue, which I think is pretty heartening to see.
Mm-hmm.
So coming up in 2025, Monash is talking about, you kind of mentioned earlier in the interview, they're talking about revising their ESG statement. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty pivotal, I think, for their relationship to Woodside. Can you talk to us a little bit about why 2025 is a big year for Woodside Action and what you guys have got coming up in terms of trying to push back against this partnership?
Yeah, for sure. So there's two main things. Woodside will actually respect our ESG statement. And this is something interesting Simon, one of our staff, told me yesterday. If we do include oil and gas in our ESG statement, this partnership can't be renewed because Woodside won't do it. I think it might be a stakeholder thing or something. And also, this partnership, I think it's been a 5-year kind of contract, and that is up for renewal probably towards the end of the year. So if there's any time to get behind this campaign, it's now. We really, really don't want this contract to be renewed, and we want Woodside's name off the building.
We have a forum coming up on the 20th of August, which is open to everyone. So that's actually going to be held on campus. So
is that open to people outside of the Monash community?
Yep. Yes. Yep. So that is open to any person who just wants to learn a bit more about the partnership and wants to be more involved. And we will definitely have more information around that. So you can check our socials closer to the date.
If you're a band or a musician who would like to come along, we're going to be doing some music and stuff. So, yeah. We have a Instagram, @WoodsideMonash, just look us up. And yeah, send us a message, that would be awesome. And yeah, we have a website, you can sign up to our Action Network to keep updated. And also, if you'd like to learn more about the Burrup Pub in general, Save Our Songlines is an awesome campaign up there, and they have an amazing website where you can learn about what's happening and the, yeah, songlines and history and connections to sky, land and sea country up there. So yeah. Check that out.
But yeah, join now. Like, it's just absolutely incredible. We have so many people and like Monash cannot hide from us now. Like, they have to listen to us. Like,
we're making a lot of noise.
We have a lot of people now. Like, they cannot silence us, like, genuinely. So Monash, watch out.
The Victorian state government is planning repressive new laws to restrict protest, including bans on protective masks and lock-on devices, increased police search powers, restrictions on symbols of resistance, such as flags, and creation of so-called safe zones around religious buildings, putting significant areas of the CBD off limits. We must say no to this attack on democracy. Protest is a fundamental human right. Join the fight to defend it at a mass rally hosted by Defend Dissent Coalition on Tuesday, 12th of August, 5:30 p.m. at Parliament House. Defend Dissent Coalition is a 3CR supporter.
You're back with Tobia and Annie on Solidarity Breakfast, and we're going to take a new direction. I had a chat with Simon Reach from, he's made a film called Bunagilla, The Migrant's Journey, and it's part of the Melbourne Documentary Film Festival. It's going to be shown on Friday the 25th. It's actually bigger than Ben-Hur, this. It's got two screens and live musical accompaniment and all the rest of it, and it's built around interviews. I'll leave it to Simon to tell you what it's all about. But actually, the Friday the 25th session is sold out. So if you want to see this film, you need to go to, it's at the Nova. It's on at 7:50 p.m. on Sunday the 27th. If you make a booking, you can get to see this pretty extraordinary affair.
Tell my listeners a little bit about how you have come to this story. I know it's generational, so tell me.
Sure. Okay. Well, the first thing that happened was I did a Bachelor of Audio, and to finish it, you had to do a capstone project. And I had, for quite a while, thought about my father's story in him growing up in Germany during the war. And so I attempted to make a film about it, but COVID hit. And then I actually, what I did create was a podcast. And by doing that, I found out so many stories I had never heard my father tell me, and all of my siblings also were fascinated, and it made me, when I realized that after the war, which was really violent and upsetting for him, he wanted to come to a new peaceful country, and it was totally luck of any kind that he came to Australia, because he really wanted to go to America. And they just said, no, America's full. How about this country? And he said, well, where even is Australia? So he didn't even know. And so by charting that, I realised that he went through the camp Bonagilla near Albury Wodonga. And so when the podcast was released and I won a few awards in America, I thought, well, maybe I could connect with the camp and do some more interviews like this. So I went up there. And they actually had hardly any recordings or anything that had been kept. And I thought this was a shame and something that history needs to have. So because I felt this is a huge missing piece in how Australia has eventually become the nation it is, because actually, just to put a little footnote there, they had been accepting migrants and their policy was only from the British Isles. And so they hadn't even thought about these other people. And so it was actually because of the war and the displaced persons, the fact that the communists had taken over so many countries and the refugees just couldn't go back there. So Australia did sign on and take on these refugees. So that's why Bongilla is a bit like Ellis Island in America, where that's where the most of the migrants came to, and then they were farmed out to various places, because most of them came on a contract. They would pay for the ship over, but you had to do jobs they found you for the next 2 years, which is a story in itself, because some of them came out as scientists, as musicians, ballerinas, whatever, and they were told at the camp, look, we know you guys have faked all these, you know, these certificates you have, so you're just going to do what we tell you. And just like the story of Dr. Carl, his father was quite an intellectual and ended up driving taxis. And there was quite a lot of resistance from racism and putting them down, calling them dirty. And look, you know why this story, even though it's historical, it's actually kept circling around like a broken record to right now, when they're saying, oh, these overseas migrants are bringing in crime, are bringing this, that, and taking our jobs. And so in a way, my documentary wants to say that even though we've learned a lot, we're still replaying the old stuff, and even to the point where the war was a reason for them coming over. And look at all the wars we've got. You know, there's going to be more displaced people. And in fact, my father thought that from the total destruction that he saw in Berlin, it was flattened. There wasn't a glass pane even intact. He thought there would never be another war like that, that everyone would understand. But it's not the case. So anyway, once I'd gathered quite a few interviews of people, I started to realise I wanted to do something with it. And so I came up with this idea of a live show where I have two screens on stage, one giant screen, which is the interviews, second screen, which has their home movies, their photographs, documents, and then I play on stage with a grand piano and a string quartet. Well, we've been selling out crowds all around Australia, because the migrants and the fact that it ripples right out, where one in every 15 people have a direct link to the camp, that people just flocked to it, because if they weren't a migrant and wanted to listen to what the show was about, they were relatives of migrants who had never heard the story. Their parents had probably passed away, or they wanted to understand, well, what did my parents go through? And for them, they've been saying to me, you've filled in so many pieces. And I think because it's so emotional, there's a lot of tears, and yet there's also joy, because I mix in some funny stories as well. You know, these people are so resilient, and they're a real inspiration to us all, really.
Well, it's interesting. I was aware of Bongilla because I've heard stories from different people. The people who used to run Discurio, which was a very highbrow sort of record shop in Melbourne, he spent 2 years building railways. When he first came here. Anyway, so they used to talk about things like that. So I was aware of this stuff. And the other one that I was aware of was how the people there, they were great cooks, and they thought Australians were just the worst cooks. They couldn't believe how bad they were. So we've got a lot to thank them for, I'll have to say, on a whole lot of levels.
Oh, definitely. In fact, there's quite a few stories in there about the cooks and some real funny stories. You know, they don't think that this will be a sad story. It's actually, it weaves horrific things with funny and very inspirational things. I think that's why it's getting such an audience.
A whole lot of things that you've just said that make a lot of sense watching this film. One of them is just how horrific war is, and you take us straight to on the ground, where people are actually experience these things. And a couple of the older women, they actually say it out loud, say, it's taken me 70 years to be able to talk about this because it was so terrible.
Yes, yes. In fact, that's quite a theme here, because a lot of these people never told their children, and they never shared it. And So some of the children would come with me just to make sure that it was okay with the older person, and then they would say later, I never heard that. So just like I did with my own father, these people say to me, I never knew that. What? How come they told you? You know. But I think I have a real thirst and knowledge for this, and I just want to, any little rabbit hole, I'll go down it. And I think this is a real testament too to how you relate with your parents too, because it's sometimes at the shows I get people who say, I wish I would have asked. That is probably one of the most common things. I wish I would have asked, and it's too late now, it's gone. So that's why it's quite critical for me to keep getting these stories, because, you know, in 5 or 10 years, this generation will be gone.
And that was part of a chat I had with Simon Reich, who has made this film called Bonegilla, The Migrant's Journey. We're going to put the longer version of that chat in our podcast.
Really interesting that, like, I mean, just the misremembering of history and how stories are told.
Exactly. And also the incredible resilience of the people who came experiencing such terrible devastation of war, and then having to deal with the racist backlash that came with their arrival here. But as I said, the first session is sold out at the Melbourne Documentary Film Festival, but you can buy tickets for the Sunday, 27th of July, 7:50 p.m. session at the Nova on, it's a Sunday. Moving right along.
A week solidarity, Bricky Team Listener, when very, very exciting news this week. A new segment, not just for the week that was, but for 3CR. Guaranteed to make simple something most of us are finding increasingly confusing. But I'll keep you in suspense, listener, and come back to it shortly. It truly is the most exciting news we've had in a long, long time. Perhaps the most exhilarating news since former big supremo Little Johnny Howhart lost his seat, even if that Maxine McHugh one did take a bit of the gloss off it. But a week when big decisions highlighted the sheer common sense of international bodies on the one hand and the law on the other. Last week, we complimented our Minister for Environmental Disasters, Murray Sinks the Environment, for attacking a rational Save Our Songlines terra nullius non-land, non-people, for opposing the destruction of their 50,000-year-old rock art, putting those 50,000 years above the interests of Woodside with profits, far more important 40 years, at least 40 years of profit, thanks to Murray and the socialist team. Selfish, selfish, non-land, non-people. But thank goodness, UNESCO, despite expressing concern that Murray and the team's gas threaten the sacred sites, nonetheless placed them on the heritage list. Pure common sense. Well, they'll stay on the heritage list until the gas obliterates them. No, that reflects my bias. Two knowledgeable men, Murray and the Western Trublawatzi Supremo Roger Cook the Planet, both acclaim the UNESCO decision proved industry and the rock art can coexist. And don't forget, Roger informed us last week, good old fossil gas is the key to decarbonisation, which is on one level 100% true if we stop using it. And the law put in a determined bid to challenge UNESCO for reasoned logic, the federal court agreeing that Murray and the team's determined attack on climate change, if there is such a thing, by approving gas and coal, was sinking the Torres Strait Islands and destroying their environment. Yes, His Honour was highly critical of the socialists and thus asked to rule that they had a duty of care to protect the terra nullius non-land, non-people's islands, prevent the destruction government policy non-action was causing. It was a no-brainer. He ruled against the non-land, non-people. The government can destroy them to its heart's content, showing sensible capitalist law knows what's need protecting. The socialist rebutted criticism of its gas policy brilliantly, pointing out it has done more to address climate change, if there is such a thing, than the caring business class party hayseed and sheep coalition lot. Now, as a rebuttal, a defence, we're not sure that's the most potent. They just had to do something. Then the Victorian Court of Appeal threw in a serious bid to outdo UNESCO and the Federal His Honour, although I think it's close to a triple dead heat, dismissing a Department of Workplace Relations prosecution of Bruck Textile Technologies, real name, which hit the old financial brick wall. Bruck law-abiding, caring employers Philip Bart and Ronald Johnson, again, real names, law-abiding because their honours ruled they were lawful in owing their lazy, avaricious workers $3.5 million and probably a fair bit in super. See, the bill was picked up by the public purse through the taxpayer-funded safety net. The government alleging they intended to dud their workers and wanted against money back. But their honour showed the sheer logic of capitalist law ruling that, this is true, listener, if directors believe their employees will be paid through the safety net, they are not criminally liable under the corporation's law offence banning deals that avoid employee entitlements. What a sensible, practical ruling. On that ruling, the public purse should be responsible for all workers dudded of their entitlements. Dudded? Tut, tut, Kevin, how unfair. Good, caring employers knowing that to observe the law as ruled by their honours, they know the public purse will meet their responsibilities, which are not their responsibilities, but our responsibilities. Hard as it is to believe, the government suggests maybe the law needs a bit of a change, like making directors and or related entities responsible for worker entitlements. Good grief. Do they want to put the public safety net out of business? But we must heap praise on one very caring employer, multinational childcare corporate Busy Don't Bees Pregnant, which employed a new human relations business partner so impressed with her, they pleaded with her to reduce her 3-month notice period, which she did. At that time, discovering she was pregnant, informed Busy Don't Bees Pregnant and was told she didn't have the job after all. Poor Busy Don't Bees. She's claiming discrimination, taking the case to the True Blue Aussie Human Rights Commission under the socialist respected work laws. Her lawyer and she are making silly, irrational, anti-caring employer comments like, a company that profits from parenthood shouldn't be tearing up employment contracts with pregnant employees. What sort of message does this send to the thousands of mothers who place their children in the care of this company because they have to work? What silly comments. Of course Busy Not Bees has nothing against pregnancy. It's the basis of its profits, the more the wealthier, but understandably, not when it comes to its own workers. And once again, thank goodness for the common sense of capitalist law. See, if Busy Not Bees loses the discrimination case, it faces the full force of the respected work law, and the crippling penalty is, well, there's no penalty. The socialists just forgot to add that bit to the legislation. So Busy Not Bees must be shaking at the bee's knees. OK, we've kept you on tenterhooks long enough. The exciting news, 3CR will provide a 2-minute update, an update every 2 minutes on the current status of the US, of the UN, of the US, of the world, Big Supremo, Donald Trump, or the Paw's latest tariff threats, with timetables, changed timetables, percentages, changed percentages, targets, changed targets, every 2 minutes, keeping us as up to date as possible. Reporting, for instance, because we haven't heard they've been lifted, the status of that huge tariff on those Antarctic penguins and seals, who need to do a lot more grovelling and promise to purchase all their seafood from the US of. Although their cause could be made easier if Donald simply declared all Antarctic seafood US of property, like he declared the seabed, seafloor, all over the world, US of property. All 3CR programs will cross every 2 minutes for an up-to-date report, acknowledging, of course, that by the time we broadcast the report, it will almost certainly be out of date, but only by a minute or so. I hope you're as excited as we are, listener. Music shows may be restricted to repeat after repeat of the minute waltz, but it's worth it. Now, to show how easily good, honest people can make a simple little error, former caring business class party minister but going overseas all the time and being a perfectly good little prefect, Julie Bash Up the Workers, for instance. Julie, apart from running her own consultancy, is also Chancellor of ANU, where they are slashing spending by sacking, or sorry, sadly having to let go staff and cut courses. ANU provides her with an office in a 20-storey tower. 20 stories in Canberra, I hear? Well, 20-storey tower by the Swan River. Yeah, I know, that's the other side of the country, but Julie Chancellor's from there, and last year her little office cost the cash-strapped uni an insignificant 800 grand. No, be fair, 790,000. Oh, and ANU coughed up another 800 grand, though, to renovate it before she moved in. And the small error? Well, Julie, we know in the past, defended honourable industries like asbestos and tobacco, and now her consultancy has lots of honourable fossils as clients. Well, documents dealing with share changes in her business show its address as, it can't be, but it is, the Swan River office paid for by cash-strapped ANU. Further, it is also listed as her residential address. But no problems. One of her staff cleared it up. It was, yes, an error. Not an error, but again, no problems. ANU also provides her with two staff for a mere $257,500, who are both also employees of, you guessed it, her consultancy. But ANU assures us there is no conflict of interest. Oh, and a Perth-based ANU chancellor, her travel bill was only $150,000. We're sure it's worth it. No doubt she's providing all sorts of advice on how ANU can save money. Wonder if in those photos of a younger Donald and misogynist sleaze Jeffrey Epstein looking very pally, close buddies, with his arm around a young woman, if Donald told Jeffrey then he, Jeffrey, was a creep. Or has he just realised Jeffrey was a creep as he learns what Jeffrey was really up to, about which Donald would not have had the slightest idea at the time. Anyway, now he's a creep, so there's no need to release the list of clients and associates which may or may not exist, although can't help wondering why Donald is so opposed to the list being made public. Surely not. The coalition as an opposition certainly lifts the standard of debate, doesn't it? Like its attack on big supremo Anthony Albanese's visit to China. Indulgent, it screamed. There. Philosophical debate run riot, including criticising his visit to see pandas, and I can't help myself in the very bad joke department. We assume that's pandemonium. At least the coalition and our minister for being offensive and train-killing Richard Malls the bad guys agree we must train-kill evil China sooner rather than later. With the US of pointing out that as True Blue Aussie throws trillions to the US of merchants of death, those trillions demand True Blue Aussie join the US of in that train-killing. Although, thank goodness, Richard and the coalition don't need any encouragement in that area. Though we're not sure they've thought through how train killing with evil China might go. Ensuring we enjoy that warm, cosy feeling of safety, the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute reported merchants of death expenditure rose 9.4% in the past year to 4.1 trillion. Real figure, 4.1 trillion worldwide. This peacenik mob made ludicrous claims like the massive increase on things that kill was affecting social programs that don't kill, guns or butter, it said, which could affect societies for years. How negative. Thankfully, the positive was put by a filthy rich asset management corporate, hoping Donald can turn NATO from a cosy World War II relic into a 21st century war economy alliance. Let's hope so. What a thrilling thought. Thrilling future for the planet. A 21st century war economy, which we thought we already had. Obviously, that 4.1 trillion isn't nearly enough. Finally, wonder what the Palestinian non-land, non-people being slaughtered, destruction and genocided think of that. Good morning.
Good morning, Kevin. And on the line we've got Manana Kadasame, from the Salon Workers Red Flag Union. G'day, Manana. Hello?
Hi.
Hello, how are you this morning?
Oh, I'm fine, thank you.
And thank you very much for taking our call. Can you tell our listeners why you've come to Australia?
Oh, actually, my comrade, my friend invited me. So, yes, I'm with her. She's introducing so many other comrades and meeting and I'm sharing my experience. That's the reason I'm with my friend.
So you're part of a union, the Salon Workers Red Flag Union. Who do you cover?
We work with the plantation workers, rubber plantation workers. And as well as, actually, we cover garment workers and we also organise domestic workers.
And your union's been really pivotal in representing especially women in these industries and the plights they have under the wage labour system in Sri Lanka.
Actually, it's not only women, men also in this sector. But this is more feminized sector, so it's like 69% are women workers. So therefore, we have to focus women workers' issues.
And we've been told that when we drink our tea, that we should be really thinking about plantation workers' struggles against worsening conditions. What's happening?
Actually, it is like because they went through like 200 years exploitation. It's still continuing. So what is happening now is that these workers, generation by generation, they were exploited. Still, they are extreme exploitation is going on. So now what is happening, all these workers, the plantation workers, when the British colonized period, they started the check roll system. That means it's a permanent work. So they will get at least EPF, ETF, and maternity benefits, basic compensations, leave, and trade union rights. So all these basic rights were there. But currently, what is happening, the companies are trying to informalize the sector. So that process started. When I say informalization, that's exactly like what is casualization. So the workers will lose the permanent wage, they will lose the maternity benefits, EPF, ETF, compensation, trade union rights, everything they are losing. There are some areas already they started. So it's the workers' job, in danger. So this is what currently is happening. But what I want to say is it's very, very important. The plantation sector itself, its structure, it's a patriarchal structure. And also these workers are isolated. Isolated means they live inside the plantation, they work there. Their houses are like in the lime rooms. It's a small, tiny, tiny connected room.
Yep.
So they don't know what is happening outside because they everything inside.
Yep.
So this is a well-planned structure to keep them, when they both countries, the slavery system. Now I will call, still it's modern slavery system, right? It didn't get yes. out from that.
Yeah. So the tea plantations form a very important part of the Sri Lankan economy, I'm assuming.
Of course. Actually, these are the workers. They came from India and they cleaned the jungle. And they are the people built the Sri Lankan economy. And they are backbone of Sri Lankan economy. But it's anybody didn't recognize them even until now.
So they don't have citizenship.
Yeah, it is very sad. It's very sad. And if you see their wage, it's they are doing that means overwork,
yeah.
But they are underpaid.
Yeah, yeah. And are you saying that it's generational? Because they live within the plantation, the children of the plantation workers are probably being born into this slave system as well?
Of course, yes, yes. Because they are, even though they are going to the, I'm a plantation worker's child,
yeah.
Right? My mother was a tea plucker. But it's the children, they're born in there, but even though they are going to the schools, but they come back to that same line room. They are living there. So there are the school, even though they got a free education, but always the living condition and circumstance, the housing for the children, it's not to educate for studying. They can't come back and study because it's a tiny room. And father, mother, children, most of the families, it's overcrowded.
And do they have electricity?
Electricity recently, yes and no. But most of them can't pay the electricity. Still, there are so many families without electricity. But electricity, actually, they started to provide. But a lot of workers can't pay the bill.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Who owns these plantations?
Actually, plantation lands are owned by government. But it's in 1992-93 when they privatized the plantation sector. What they did was they gave the plantation sector to manage to the 23 companies. So the companies, it's a long lease. It's a 90 years or some long lease. So,
but are those companies owned by prestigious families within Sri Lanka, or are they foreign owned?
No. It's all outside, but it's very difficult to trace which company, which brand. But the locally managed by Sri Lankans, but it's not. That is like interim management. They have so many structures. But locally, we deal with it's Sri Lankans, employer federation. Everybody Sri Lankans.
And just for our listeners, yes, just for our listeners, just maybe paint a picture of what these workers had to go through, because there's pretty incredible amounts of tea leaves that they're required to pick, and they have deductions for baskets, and there's all sorts of like small nuances in the way that they're exploited as well.
Actually, that is the point. They're extremely exploited, because for a day, workers need to pluck. It's depend on, it varies estate to estate, but mostly 18 kilos to 20 kilos. Some estates now it increased like 23, 24 kilos. And actually what is going through here, it's for a day, they have to weigh from twice. Some estates three times, most of the estates twice they have to weigh, like morning half hour, then evening again. So when they pluck, even though workers are well aware how many kilos they pluck, because for many years they are plucking.
Yeah, yeah,
when
they're aware.
When they go to the master shed, they have to weigh, and the workers are not allowed to see the scale, right?
Yes.
So again, the companies will say, we didn't stop them to seeing. So one is their knowledge to see. Another thing is the people who are in a weighing place, they won't allow women to see how many kilos they took. Then they deduct 3 kilos. Most of the estate 3 kilos, some estate 4 kilos, so it's more than 2 kilos they did that.
Yeah. They're cheating. And it's funny, you know, because that's an old ruse that appears in folk songs about putting the hand on the way on the scale so that they cheat the person.
Yes, they do a lot of cheating. They do a lot of cheating. So, that, you know, that's highly exploited. I can just quickly say that sometimes the workers carry the urea bag. It's a very light bag. Right. Even they say we deduct one, that bag is not 1 kilo. Right. They deduct for bag 1 kilo. They deduct for water. So it is a cheating. And for a day, you know, some workers, they are tea leaves, they pluck very hard and they bring it. And when they bring it, they have to, the gnome fixing is there. So when they have to give like 20 kilos, what they will do, they deduct 3 kilos. Then that means they won't get full day payment. So it's 1,350 rupees is the day payment now, but that will go for half payment because they didn't pluck according to norm. So they cheated from the kilos, they cheated from their wage. When their wage gone down, then their EPF, ETF affected. So it is one after other, it's like a chain, how they exploit. It's a systemic exploitation.
And also with the casualisation, it's not just insecurity. It allows the company to decide, we're not going to, you're a troublemaker. So I'm wondering about how the Salon Workers Red Flag Union is strategising, what you guys are doing, and I guess then what we can help do to help.
The casualisation, actually, we really want, because the tea, everybody, the consumers are all over the world, right? So everybody, when they have their tea, they have to think, these workers are working hard, and you know they are not. This is a working class struggle, right?
Yeah.
We are not asking for charity. We are not asking for a couple of rupees to more. It's not only that. This is justice, dignity. So we really want everybody to think about, right, and pressurize the companies, pressurize the government, because it's government responsibility looking after the citizens, even though it's company managed. So we want these workers, workers' dignity. One thing I will say today, 2025, and AI is taking over the world, but in Sri Lankan tea plantation workers, they don't have toilet. They don't have eating place. So how much, still they didn't consider these are human. Forget about consider as a worker. They didn't consider they are human. They didn't consider they need, when the workplace need a toilet. They work more than 8 hours. So it's everything. One, we can talk.
So like, which brands are people, do we need to be aware of?
Oh, actually, I don't have that information in my hand because we are trying to trace.
Yep.
We don't know, it's so many brands there and which one we have to, because even we don't know from which estate this brand.
Yeah, I guess that because we're running out of time, but I just have to say, I mean, it's so big, your fight is so big, and it is a fight that all of us should be part of. You're actually speaking today at 3 p.m. at Balam Place, which is 15 Phoenix Street, Brunswick. So people can go along to your talk and talk to you a bit more about this, and you probably will have more information. But you've been invited to come here and speak. And is it a feeder that you're helping you out? Are there any local contacts where people can follow this through? Is it a feeder that has invited you to come to Australia?
Yeah, actually, yes. Vinak, she's the person invited.
Yeah. It just means that people can get more information about this situation and work out how they can be most helpful to you.
Okay, yeah. So they can communicate with Vinette, and I am with her.
Yeah.
So, yes, she knows more about this situation.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. And people can come and listen to what you have to say at 3 p.m. today at 15 Phoenix Street, Brunswick. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you. Thank you so much given this opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you. And good luck.
And thank you. Thank you. Okay.
Yeah. Bye. Okay. Bye. Bye.
That was Minaha Kandasamy. And she's from the Salon Workers Red Flag Union. So if you think you've got a hard working day, think of those tea plantation workers and the outrage that is actually happening right now. So much for AI and space flight and
chilling work conditions out there.
Yeah, absolutely outrageous. That number, that time and place for today to listen to join Minaha Kandasamy, who is talking about the workers' struggle in Ceylon or Sri Lanka, 3 p.m. Saturday at Balam Balam Place, 15 Phoenix Street, Brunswick. That's it for Solidarity Breakfast this morning. I have one quick thing to read. I was given this about the Kensington Makers Market. Sometimes leave the northern suburbs so you can go to the Kensington Makers Market on the third Sunday of each month and consider the unique, creative and very varied products definitely made by the person at the stall. Only this Makers Market and the similar Hawthorne Makers Market on the first Sunday of the month are focused entirely on giving Melbourne's artists and artisans an opportunity to show and sell their fine creations completely aside from imported and mass-produced cheap stuff. Kensington Makers Only Market is from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. and stores can accept payment by cash, paid, or credit card. Google the Kensington Makers Market. And that is a wrap.
Thank you so much, and we'll see you next week. We're going to go out with 99 Poste, Rigurgito Antifascista. It means like anti-fascist vomit. just you have to throw it out, you know? But exceptional song, legendary Italian band. We'll see you all next week.
Quella di poter campare, campare liberato dal lavoro salariato, ma la tua violenza l'ho già spiegato, è l'azione più eclatante, miserabile, impotente di chi non può far più niente, disprezzato dalla gente. C'ho un rigurgito antifascista, se vedo un punto nero ci sparo a vista. C'ho un rigurgito antifascista, se vedo un punto nero ci sparo a vista. C'ho un rigurgito antifascista, se vedo un punto nero ci sparo a vista. Miserabile servo dei servi del potere, tu questo lo sai bene, tu fa incazzare. Voto
proprio un cesso, non ti sai organizzare, vigliacco represso, incominci a picchiare, di te rivoluzione, fottutissimi vermi, ma siete solo servi dei servi.